Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday, April 19th, 2018. It's just about 3:30 UTC as we're starting to record today. I'm Sam Minter. Ivanbo is not with us again this week. I believe this time around he's in Brazil and doing all kinds of things and businessy things and having meetings and all kinds of stuff. So he can't be with us. So instead, we have Ed and Daryl. Hello, Ed and Daryl.
Hello.
Both of you have been on the show before, but do you want to each give like a, 30-second intro to yourselves? Let's start with Daryl.
Oh, okay. Well, my name is Daryl, and I live pretty close to Sam. I live in Redmond, Washington, and I work at a large state university.
Wonder what that could be.
Yeah.
Okay, and Ed?
I'm Ed Haynes. I'm a retired Army surgeon, and I don't work at all anymore. I just am preparing to run triathlons this summer.
I'm so jealous of you, Ed. You know, I may only be 46, but I feel like I'm so ready to retire. I would love to be able to, and I'm nowhere near that.
It's I tell you what, I don't know how I ever had time to work. It's just it's a busy life.
Yes. Okay. So our agenda today, we're going to have four segments, two international-ish type of topics and two domestic scandal-y type of topics. So those four topics are going to be Syria, North Korea. Those are obviously the two international ones, and the domestic ones, Comey and his book tour and everything coming out of that, and finally the last one, Cohen and the Cohen investigation and all of the stuff coming out of that. So those are the topics. We're going to keep this intro really short this time around, so we're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back with foreign policy. Back after this. No, it's not the beginning of the show again. We're just taking a little time to credit the artist responsible for the music we use at the beginning and end of the show. What you are listening to right now is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Music we close our show with is Celestial Soda Pop. Both of these songs are from Deep Breakfast. Now platinum, Deep Breakfast was the first independently released album ever to be certified gold by the RIAA. Ray Lynch's other albums are The Sky of Mind, No Blue Thing, Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening, and The Best of Ray Lynch. You can check out Ray Lynch or buy his music at raylynch.com, iTunes, Amazon, or anywhere you usually find music. Okay, so what do you guys want to hit first, Syria or North Korea?
with missiles? I guess
so.
Would be Syria.
Okay, well, so between the time when we recorded last week's show and when I put it out last Saturday, we did have the strike on Syria from the Trump administration and France and the UK that had been talked about previously because, you know, everybody expected there was the chemical weapons attack and, you know, you got to do something. So there'd be an attack. there was apparently somewhat of a debate within the administration on just how big to make this and whether it would be an ongoing series of continuing attacks or a one-off, with apparently Mattis being the one arguing to keep it relatively limited, with other folks in the administration arguing for much deeper involvement. There was a report also that Mattis was saying that we really needed congressional authorization before doing this, and he was overridden on that. But it seems like he did get the more limited engagement that he asked for. There was enough of a delay where they were talking about this all week long that from most reports I've seen, say that the Syrians had plenty of time to move anything sensitive out of the way before the attacks happened. So just like a year ago, we probably mostly hit empty buildings and airfields. So
that seems likely.
So what do you guys think of this? I had a mini, like, less than 10-minute rant on this in last week's show. So let me get both of your opinions. So, Ed, first, is this what we should be doing in Syria? Was this good, bad, indifferent? What's going on? What do you think?
You know, I keep coming back to talking about strategic planning and the importance of when you're going to do any kind of a management or military exercise, you need to have a mission statement. And what the hell are we doing in Syria? And in the absence of a mission, then all you do is you kind of react to whatever happens. So they threw some poison gas out and killed 45 or 50 people. And we sent a bunch of bombs. But before we sent the bombs, we said, you want to be real sure to be out of the areas where these bombs are going to land. So all we did was to blow up a couple buildings. I just don't see that we're getting anywhere. We're spending a hell of a lot of money. The Syrian civilians are being killed. I think the latest estimates I've seen are somewhere around 400,000 to 500,000 people killed. Most of those are civilians. They're not the soldiers and the combatants. That's another number. But I don't see that we gained anything or that we have anything to gain from doing what we're doing. It's time for somebody to sit down and say, let's think about this and decide, what do we want? You know, what do we want? Do we want to replace Assad? Do we want to make Assad a decent guy? Do we want to wipe Syria off the map and replace it with something else? Yeah, you gotta decide what we want to do and then do that.
So let me play. I think I agree with you, but let me play devil's advocate for a second. Since we don't have that kind of strategy today, at least none that's visible, in response to the chemical weapons attack, what should we have done? Should we have done nothing?
I think that what we need to do is to put together a think tank with a bunch of bright guys and say, let's think about this. What do we want to do? If we want to say no more chemical weapons, then we need to develop a strategic plan that will eliminate chemical weapons in Syria. That could be done. It would be difficult. It'd be bloody. It'd be expensive. But it could be done. But if that's it, so far there's probably less than 1,000 people killed with chemical weapons in Syria, as opposed to, as I said, 400,000 to 500,000 people killed with regular munitions. Yeah. Does it really matter to the guy who's dead whether he was poisoned or shot?
Or blown up. That was part of my rant last week and a year ago last week, was the whole, I understand some of the reasons why we have the prohibition on chemical weapons that was put in place after World War I, but in the end, it seems almost a silly distinction. Like, you should be trying to figure out how to minimize the number of people killed, period, not care about how they're killed. But, Ed, your turn. I mean, sorry, I already did Ed. I keep getting you two confused. I don't know why. Daryl.
We look a lot.
Yes, exactly. Daryl, your turn. What do you think of all this?
Well, I am not sure what I think about it. But what I can tell you is that this administration has just lied and changed their mind. Well, the president changes his mind. I just don't trust what's going on. I mean, I didn't trust the Bush administration either, and I was right when they said that they were, trying to, find out whether there were weapons of mass destruction. That was a big dog and pony show.
In Iraq, yeah.
It seems like it might be theater. I don't know, because if they were coordinating with the Russians, then it's not clear to me that the Syrians didn't know as well.
Yeah.
And I can't help asking the question, call me a conspiracy theorist, but was this a show for the American people? Was it like Russia trying to help Trump with his approval ratings, or was this really a message to Assad? I'm not sure any of those things worked, but I just don't know what to believe.
My thought on that, I mean, the coordination with Russia, what they say is that basically we're talking about the quote unquote standard deconfliction messages, which they've got a system worked out in Syria where whenever the Russians are flying planes or the Americans are flying planes, they basically reserve airspace and say, okay, we're going to be in this area at this time, stay away. And this is happening constantly all the time in Syria every single week, of all sides giving these kinds of messages. Now, they're not necessarily always saying, we're going to attack this place at this time, whatever, but they're saying this particular air corridor, which may be fairly wide, stay away during this time. And the reason is because both the Americans and Russians, from the very beginning of their involvement here, have felt that it's actually very important not to accidentally have them run into each other. And I'm not necessarily talking mid-air collision, but just any place where, you're putting, warplanes in close vicinity to each other, you don't want something accidental happening that causes an escalation. You want it to be something. If you're going to escalate, you want to have thought about it, not have it happen accidentally. So they've been doing this deconfliction.
Go in with airplanes, though. We shot missiles and the Russians could very well shoot some of those missiles down.
No, there's two things there. One is that this deconfliction goes for any air vehicle, so it counts just as much for a drone or a missile or whatever as it would for a manned aircraft. But also, we very carefully, the Russian air defense systems don't cover the whole country. They cover specific areas where the Russians are stationed and have bases and stuff like that. And we didn't attack anywhere near those. So we attacked near some places where there was some Syrian air defense, but they're not completely intermingled. That's undoubtedly part of the strategy too. I mean, we could have, attacked near Russian bases, but we didn't. I mean, we carefully chose. Both sides seem to have been fairly careful in terms of Russia versus the U.S. Both sides seem to have been relatively careful about avoiding each other. And part of what the Russians, statement after the fact was, they said basically none of the American stuff came anywhere near us, so we're okay. Is there a meta level of coordination of, like, from a policy point of view, Russians trying to make Trump look better or whatever? I don't think so. I think it's much simpler than that. Like, Trump felt like he had to do something. He didn't really care what the something was. He wanted to make a big bang. He got talked down from all reports. He wanted to do a lot more than this. This comes to all of the craziness of Donald Trump being consistent, of course, because like 2 weeks ago, he was talking about pulling out of Syria entirely, right?
Right.
But then something like this happens and he wants to be aggressive and make a big splash. And, he made some tweets that actually mentioned Putin and were aggressive towards Russia, blah, blah, blah. But I think the constant theme on Trump is everything is about appearances, not about actual results. So, like, he couldn't care less or maybe doesn't even cross his mind, like, to evaluate something like this based on, does it actually reduce the chemical weapons capacity of Syria in the long term, or does it actually move things towards the resolution of the conflict in Syria? No, it's all about, like, can we say we made a big reaction? Can we say we were stronger than Obama was when this happened to Obama? And it really doesn't go any deeper than that. And then the, you know, Mattis and the Defense Department try to do what they can within those parameters without making too much worse.
Yep. Right. Well, that's the other question, is whether it was lawful or not, since it certainly doesn't fall under the authorization after 9/11. So it's hard to know how this is justified legally, and I haven't really seen many analyses of that. But I just don't know where it falls. I guess the president can take some limited military action and then report to Congress within a certain period of time. I don't remember the details of that. Maybe it falls under that.
On the War Powers Resolution, from what I understand, it may not actually apply. This may be straight out illegal. Because the War Powers Resolution does allow the president to do certain types of actions and then go back to Congress after the fact. But they're actually fairly limited in scope, according to the direct text of the War Powers Resolution. However, it's never been successful. Congress has been really bad about actually pushing for their rights on that. So, for instance, the Clinton administration was involved with the Balkans, and there was no argument about self-defense, no argument about any of that, and they never got the proper approval from Congress, if I remember correctly. And Congress never pushed back. And so the problem with all of this legality on the war-making powers is that Congress has consistently ceded its authority, like, and never, you have not had a situation where Congress has actually, for instance, gone and impeached a president because they've engaged in military activity without a declaration of war. Congress just doesn't want to get into that game, and that seems to be a sort of bipartisan thing. Neither party wants to. Congress just doesn't want that responsibility.
There's a pretty good reason for that, which is that the when soldiers are sent over and they're fighting, if you say, "My goodness, you shouldn't have done that," then you're putting those soldiers at a little increased risk, perhaps. And Congress don't have the balls to say, we'll take the risk of being unpopular to stop something that's illegal. And they're afraid that if they do something that might endanger soldiers, that they'll get voted out of office. And maybe they would get it voted out of office, but that doesn't mean they could do some other things to stop this continual war games that our presidents, and it's been the last several in a row, have played war games with the lives of soldiers and civilians and soldiers of other countries.
There is a partisan aspect to it, too, though, because you have a very different dynamic when it's an opposite party in the presidency and Congress, where the Congress is much more willing to go against a president who's on the other side of the partisan divide. Even then, they don't really like to, though, because they don't want to be in this business. But when it's the same party, you almost never get very much traction there.
Hmm. Yeah, well, so Obama, one of the differences is Obama did try to get congressional authorization and did not get it, did not succeed.
Yep.
And I think that he still was doing some bombing in Syria, but it was always against ISIS targets, not against Assad.
Well, and that's one of
I'm not positive about that. That's my recollection.
I think you're right there. I mean, the first one of these chemical weapon attacks was unique and distinct because it was the first time that the U.S. had targeted the Syrian regime directly, as opposed to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or anybody else fighting in that region. And that's why it's not covered under the existing authorization for the use of military force from right after 9/11, because that authorization was very narrowly tailored. Well, I say very narrowly, but it was written, it was actually relatively broad, but it did say, Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-related organizations that may have been part of what was responsible for 9/11. And that has been stretched and strained, like, to even call ISIS a part of that, because ISIS and Al-Qaeda are enemies themselves, really stretching it. But it certainly didn't cover attacks against, you know, actual national governments.
Right. What do you call it? Sovereign governments, I think, is the term. I think there was a story on this when I was waking up on National Public Radio this morning, and they were pointing out that is the big difference. There's no way the authorization applies to sovereign governments. And that, of course, presumes that the Taliban must not have been considered a sovereign government, because he certainly went in and bombed the Taliban.
Well, that there was, the notion behind Taliban, and they were the sovereign government of Afghanistan at the time, but they were harboring Al-Qaeda, was and the wording was specifically allowed to do that. Basically, it's anybody who aided or abetted the organization that was behind 9/11, And so it was written fairly broadly. But the point is, at this point, the Obama administration and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, all of them sort of at least played lip service to, going through the motions of talking to Congress about things. And again, I think there was some weirdness with how the Balkans worked, but the previous administrations have all sort of at least acknowledged this. The Trump administration is basically barreling full steam ahead, saying it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. We can do what we want.
Right.
And daring Congress to do anything about it. And while there's been some talk of some bipartisan measures in the last week to say something, I'm not convinced they're going anywhere at this point. Like I said at the beginning, Congress just doesn't care. And for the most part, the people don't care. I mean, there were good reasons why, the founders put the war-making powers in the Congress and not the president. But I think the majority, if you grab a bunch of people off the street, they'd say, of course the president decides that. What do you mean?
Yeah. It's the commander-in-chief.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I don't know. So before we wrap up Syria, and we haven't even started North Korea yet, but any ideas whatsoever of, like, not so much, I was going to say, of what we should be doing? I guess what we should be doing almost doesn't matter. Like, it seems like we're in there because we're in there. Donald Trump really wants to get out, I think. But has been dissuaded from doing so by various members of his staff so far. Any predictions? The only thing I can see is it's going to continue to be a mess forever, and the kind of mess where it's just a low burning constant thing that has the ever constant potential of escalating, but hopefully doesn't.
Yeah, I think we're in a situation where everything is unpredictable because so much of it depends on the whims of Donald Trump, who doesn't listen to his advisors and, comes up with ideas late at night and then tweets about them and watches the reactions, and sometimes he acts on things and sometimes he doesn't. I mean, this is how all of the worst policies of this administration seem to have originated.
Right.
Well, part of that is, especially where you're talking international relations, and basically the Department of State is almost non-existent at this point. There are so many senior diplomats that have been pushed out of office, eliminated the one whole floor of the State Department that is primarily international diplomats is apparently unstaffed right now. So, of course, we don't have any kind of a consistent international policy.
Yeah, I mean, I keep seeing people post sort of diagrams of, you know, the top 10 to 15 spots at the State Department, and almost all of them are empty at the moment. But also, in the last couple of weeks, with John Bolton coming on to the National Security Council, he has also been eliminating all sorts of people from the NSC that, you know, were remnants of, you know, whoever was before him, McMaster and everybody else, and just basically cleaning house of anybody who doesn't agree with him. But he hasn't replaced those spots either. So it's not, and those don't even require, you know, Senate confirmation or anything, but he's just firing people without necessarily having replacements ready to go.
Well, it's
here's
kind
an
of
an idea. He should put Steve Bannon on that.
Jesus. But I really think it's as if this administration is intent on just destroying our governmental functions.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Steve Bannon. I mean, his classic quote was the deconstruction of the administrative state. So, yes, at least for some of the people involved in this, that is a goal. That is a direct goal to sort of take all of these institutions that have built up over the last couple hundred years and get rid of most of them.
And the people that don't feel that way are incompetent.
Yeah. And you've got all these battles within the administration as well. So you've got a lot of folks that are of that sort of ilk that are like, State Department, we don't need a State Department. And then you've got some of the folks who do understand the reasons for the institutions. And, you know, so there's an argument that, you know, Mattis fits into that category, and Trump has basically left Mattis alone for the most part. But will that continue? What are the ups and downs? And again, it all comes back to Donald Trump has the power to wake up one morning and make drastic changes in any of these places. What you're seeing is sort of the institutional resistance across the board, where, you know, if you've got a big, large institution that is many, many thousands of people, it is hard to change it overnight. Even if you get rid of the people at the top, the people at lower levels sort of keep on chugging. But that can only go a certain extent. If you're determined to cripple some of these organizations, they're going to get crippled. And Donald Trump, very much coming from his, you know, small family business orientation, he doesn't like the idea of an organization of hundreds of thousands of people that are working for him. He wants to have, like, here are the 20 guys that I talk to every day, and they're the ones who do the stuff.
As long as they pledge loyalty.
As long as they're loyal. So let's go ahead and take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about North Korea.
Hey, we know when you listen to this show, you have thoughts about what we say. You probably want to vent about what we got wrong or what we left out, right? Or maybe you want to suggest some future topics we just haven't gotten to yet. Well then, tell us all about it. Right now, there are 4 ways to get feedback to us. First, you can go to the Curmudgeon's Corner Facebook page and leave comments on the post where we announce all the new episodes. Second, you could go to curmudgeonscorner.com, that's with a hyphen, and leave a comment there instead. Third, both Yvonne and I are on Twitter. You can talk to me at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E, or Yvonne at I-M-B-O, I-M-B-O-U. Finally, if you don't want to make your comments in a public forum like that, just email me directly at abulsme@abulsme.com. Again, that's A-B-U-L-S-M-E. But, you know, if you don't want us to mention your feedback on the show, be sure to say so, because otherwise we're probably going to respond to your comments on a future show, because, you know, that's what makes the discussion. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, we're back now. North Korea. So the, you know, same themes here, essentially, but the news from this week is that high-level conversations have begun between the U.S. and North Korea to try to arrange that summit. Donald Trump, at one point, in answer to a question, left everybody with the impression that he'd actually talked directly to Kim Jong-un already, but then they walked that back and revealed that it was Pompeo, who's the outgoing head of the CIA, who's been nominated to be the new Secretary of State, but not yet confirmed, and his confirmation is potentially in trouble. It may or may not pan out. But he flew to North Korea over Easter weekend and talked to Kim Jong-un, and, you know, quote-unquote high-level talks are underway to try to make that summit happen. Donald Trump also apparently gave his blessing to conversations between North and South Korea to actually do a peace treaty to end the Korean War, which so far there's only an armistice so far, no actual peace treaty. And Donald Trump is like, go for it. So
that's the big news. I mean, that's actually big news. I think,
although interestingly enough, I believe the armistice is not between North and South Korea. It's between, you know, the U.S. and the other folks with North Korea. So it's a little bit weird, the dynamics there. But this is one of those areas where, frankly, there's criticism for Donald Trump of just sort of blustering his way through this and not really knowing what he's doing. But at the flip side, if out of all of this, he manages to reduce tensions on the Korean Peninsula and actually have a peace treaty between North and South Korea and officially end the Korean War and get North Korea to back down a little bit, that's not a bad thing.
That's pretty cool. If this very, very old war comes to an official end, I think that's big news. As far as Pompeo going to North Korea, based on the fact that Trump tried to spin it as if it had just happened, whereas it, you know, happened weeks ago, right? I think it was weeks ago. When was Easter? That makes me think that this is more about, here I go again, sounding like a conspiracy theorist. It makes me think it's more about making him look statesmanlike so that he could get through his confirmation rather than actually doing anything real.
That's possible. I mean, I've definitely heard people sort of say that this was intentionally leaked right now at the moment that the confirmation seems to be in doubt for exactly that purpose. But again, I think that ties in completely with Donald Trump's MO on everything, is that it's all about appearances, not about reality. And so, I mean, just like the tariffs and all this kind of stuff, where, you know, he announces something really, really aggressive and then backs off for it very quickly with, you know, just maybe token concessions by the other side, but nothing that really makes a difference. But in the meantime, he can come and say, you know, I was tough and they caved and we've got a better deal now. And I think he's looking for a situation where he can do the same kind of thing with the Koreas and, you know, be able to, you know, have something that looks good on paper or it looks good on first blush, regardless of what it is when you look deeper, and declare victory and move on in the hopes that there will be more people, especially more people in his base, that just look at the surface level and not deeper and don't care. It's just like, look, he succeeded. He did this. This is one of those areas where I have to acknowledge there is a possibility that what Trump is doing now actually will break the logjam that has existed for decades in the Koreas. I'm not willing to bet on it at this point, but that possibility is certainly out there. And what every administration going back forever, practically, has done clearly hasn't worked between North and South Korea. So he's trying something new. And and Kim Jong Il is, or oh, that's the father. Kim Jong Un is willing to play ball, and do this, and now will it result in permanent peace and the reunification of the Koreans and everybody happy and joyful and blah blah blah? Probably not, but you know, I don't know. Like it's a tightrope walk though. Like what he did initially was very, very belligerent and could have gone in a very bad direction. It could have made the North and South actually come to blows. It doesn't look like that's happening at this point. It looks like they actually are coming together. Now, was it because Donald Trump was all belligerent at the beginning? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But it certainly gives him that thing that he can claim, look, everybody else failed. Now we're talking.
Well, you know, just to put a caveat in here, number one, things like armistices from wars that are 50 years old don't occur on a spur of the moment. It takes a lot, again, of that kind of thing I was talking about before, strategic planning and sitting down, negotiating, and a lot of stuff. And to have two hot-headed guys in a room and think we'll negotiate a peace settlement is really pie in the sky. More worrisome to me, though, than that, because I don't think it's going to happen, more worrisome is that our designated incoming Secretary of State, plus a whole bunch of other people in this administration, think that there's really only two choices. There's either we have an armistice and become buddies with North Korea, or we have war. Mm. There isn't any intermediate medium, you know, between the thing. And Pompeo even said that today in some news interview. Gee, we really think we could have peace, but the other alternative is war.
Right. I mean, and this is something people have been saying, is that, you know, the more cynical people are like, this is a setup where they're going into negotiation that they hope will fail and thus give them an excuse to go to war. That's one of the cynical ways of looking at it. Another thing I've heard people say repeatedly is Donald Trump and his team are just idiots. So even if they get peace, they're going to do it by giving away all kinds of stuff that we shouldn't be giving away, or they're going to just, you know, the North Korea is playing us and they're going to get everything they want out of this and we're going to get nothing, you know, or whatever. I'm willing to sort of wait it out and see what happens. I'm just glad that they're no longer like every weekend tweeting aggressive militaristic things and at each other with, you know,
insults.
I mean, we had a while back there where it seemed like every week the North Koreans were demonstrating how they could nuke the whole United States if they felt like it, and Donald Trump was threatening to nuke them back, and, you know, whose button is bigger and all this kind of stuff. And I'm glad that we've moved on past that.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about this whole ordeal this week with North Korea. It's not an ordeal, the whole news cycle. It seems to be about a possible peace treaty between North and South Korea, which really, in some sense, the United States isn't involved. I realize that's maybe simplifying things way too much. But the U.S. interest in North Korea is about getting rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons. And that seems to me like, you know, Trump's meeting with Kim Jong Il is not going to accomplish that. And neither is a peace treaty between the North and South Korea. So I'm not sure. I think this is largely theater.
Yeah,
Trump wants to have a historic accomplishment of meeting with the leader of North Korea, because then he can, you know, put another notch in his accomplishment belt or whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, and people have even said, like, if he actually manages to pull off, you know, a summit with the North Koreans, followed by a North and South Korea peace treaty, followed by the North Koreans agreeing to minimize their nuclear capabilities or their capabilities for long range weapons or whatever, you know, he could be up for the Nobel Peace Prize after all that. You know,
yeah, Yeah, you know,
and just to say another thing that people have worried in the will Donald Trump give up the farm is Donald Trump has said repeatedly that what he cares about is the North Korean ability to hit the U.S. And a lot of the regional folks are worried that he's going to go in there, make some sort of deal with the North Koreans to take their long-range ballistic missiles off the table, and once those are off the table, say, okay, everything's fine, leaving North Korea a threat to South Korea and Japan, just not to the U.S. anymore.
Well, he's got a Gulf summit going on, so they can... So
they'll work that out. Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, there's plenty of room for pitfalls here. But there are at least some hopeful elements, so we'll give them a chance and see where it goes. You know, as much as I think Donald Trump is a complete idiot on pretty much everything, and I disagree with him policy-wise on pretty much everything, I'm willing on this one to see how it plays out, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're giving the whole thing too much credit, the whole thing being Trump's actions and words. I think Trump is just happy to do something historic, which is meeting with the leader of North Korea. No, I think he has a plan beyond that.
No, I don't. I just to be clear, I don't think he has a real plan beyond that either. But he may stumble into something, just because because the parties are looking. I mean, basically, if the North Koreans have been looking for a face-saving way out of this conflict, he's opening a door for them.
Okay, Sam, when's the last time in history you can think of an occasion when countries stumbled into peace?
Yeah. Stumbling the other way seems a lot more likely, but...
That's happened a lot of times, but you know, peace is something you have to work pretty hard for, and this guy doesn't believe in work.
Yeah,
and I think South Korea is probably gets more credit. I mean, the invitation to participate in the Olympics and that kind of thing was probably as much of an opening as anything.
Yeah, and they've been driving a lot of this, to be clear. Okay, so let's wrap up this segment. One more trivia question to you, since we were talking about North and South Korea and peace treaties and all that. When did World War II legally end?
Well, it ended a couple times. You know, the European theater ended was it May or June? And then the Pacific Theater ended, and I don't remember the month anymore.
Now, I'm just looking for the year, actually.
The year. Well, it was 45 for the European Theater. And I'm not sure in Japan how much longer it went on.
That is incorrect.
Really?
World War II did not legally end until 1990.
Oh, really?
The official peace treaty, and just like the Koreas have an armistice, but not a peace treaty, the World War II ended with armistice, in Europe at least, ended with armistices, not peace treaties. The war was not officially, legally over until the reunification of Germany in 1990. That's when the peace treaty was signed.
I'll be darned. I didn't know that.
Now,
so I was in Germany when we were still at war.
Exactly.
I didn't get combat pay.
So anyway, that's just one of those trivia questions because you know, because basically the occupied powers that took over Germany had to agree to the reunification of Germany, and part of that was the official legal end of World War II. At least that's how I understood it. Now, having said that, of course, for all real purposes, World War II ended, as you said, with VE Day and VJ Day in the 40s. But legally, in terms of treaties and everything else, it wasn't really over until the reunification of Germany in 1990.
Now, with Japan, there was actually a peace treaty, a complete surrender, and their part in a peace treaty signed. So that part of it was done. Interesting.
So anyway, at least that's my understanding. I'm sure if somebody out there wants to correct me and tell me that I'm wrong. Okay, let me read the paragraph from Wikipedia. Okay. The 1945 Potsdam Agreement had specified that a full peace treaty concluding World War II, including the exact delimitation of Germany's post-war boundaries, required to be accepted by the government of Germany when a government adequate for the purpose is established. The Federal Republic had always maintained that no such government could be said to have been established until East and West Germany had been united within a free democratic state. But in 1990, a range of options continued to be maintained over whether a unified West Germany, East Germany, and Berlin could be said to represent Germany as a whole for this purpose. The key question was whether a Germany that remained bounded to the east by the Oder-Neisse line could act as a united Germany in signing the peace treaty without qualification. Under the 2+4 treaty, both the Federal Republic and the GDR committed themselves and their unified continuation to the principle that their joint pre-1990 boundaries constituted the entire territory that could be claimed by a government of Germany, and hence that there were no further lands outside those boundaries that were part of Germany as a whole. So yes, 1990, the West Germany required that East Germany be a part of it, and yeah, so there you go.
I'll be there. How about that?
Do. Sam from the future here. Quick correction. Although German unification was officially in October 1990, the final agreement by the four powers that the war was over and Germany had complete sovereignty, etc., 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 was not fully ratified until March 15th, 1991. It took a little while longer for that to happen. So it's actually 1991 was the official end of World War II, not 1990. Do. Okay. Enough of that. Let's take a break. We will be back and we will talk about the scandals of the week, basically including Cohen and Comey. And everything related to the two of them. Back after this. You're listening to this podcast. Do you like it?
No!
Do you want to support the show?
No!
Well, after you have subscribed to the show, followed us on Facebook, and told all your friends they should be listening to, what else can you do?
I won't subscribe!
You can help fund our Patreon at patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. Patreon is a way you can throw us a few bucks a month to help out with the expenses of the show. You know, web hosting, equipment, a little bit of advertising to promote the show, and maybe every once in a while some much needed sedatives for Yvonne. At different contribution levels, you can get a mention on the show, our Curmudgeon's Corner postcard, or even a Curmudgeon's Corner mug. Fun stuff.
Not fun.
In any case, the contributions help tell us that you enjoy and appreciate the show.
I really, really hate Curmudgeon's Corner.
Are we worth a buck a month?
No!
$5 a month?
No!
Or if you are nuts about us, maybe even more.
Anywhere near $1 billion.
If we're worth anything to you at all, send it our way at patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner.
Alex hates, really, really hates Curmudgeon's Corner. That's really mean, isn't it? But I hate Curmudgeon's Corner, but I really do.
Okay, we are back. So, Cohen or Comey, which one do you want to do first, guys?
I would like to tell a story about Comey.
Okay, go for it.
I was at a conference last week, and I ran into an old friend of mine who works at the FBI. He's a sort of mid-level forensic scientist, and I asked him about morale at the FBI, and he said that the firing of Comey was devastating at all levels of the FBI, and he pointed out that he gave some examples of where they had, like, demonstration days or something for the lab he was working in, and Comey stopped by and, you know, checked out the technology and stuff like that. And the next time they did it a year later, he stopped by and he recognized my friend by name. So he clearly was a person that got around, was very popular with the employees, and like a good politician, was good at memorizing names, I guess.
Yeah, I just read an article earlier today that I'll call out by Benjamin Witz on Lawfare, on lawfareblog.com, titled Behind James Comey's A Higher Loyalty. And he talks actually a bit about that. So for those of you who don't remember, Benjamin Witz is a good friend of James Comey. And, you know, when Comey leaked that there were that he'd taken notes on the Trump meetings and all that kind of stuff, those leaks went through Benjamin Witz. That's how he leaked them to the press. It's an interesting article. And in it, he does talk about how one of Comey's themes as FBI director, one of his major initiatives that he wanted to do, is sort of break down the, what's the right word for it? The way that previous heads of the FBI had been looked up to as sort of this isolated, almost godlike figure that, you know, reigned from on high and told the FBI what to do and was very unapproachable. And so he worked very, very hard at breaking down those boundaries and making sure that, like you were just saying, you know, he talked to the people who worked for him. He remembered their names. He remembered little bits about their family. He made a point of eating at the cafeteria all the time, as opposed to isolating himself and waiting in line with everybody else. Like, he wasn't going to jump the line. He, you know, this kind of thing, just to make that connection between himself and the rank and file at the FBI. And apparently, from what you're saying, he succeeded. And he was very well loved and very popular at the FBI. And, you know, there's all kinds of things we can criticize for what he did. But within the FBI, he was very popular and people were quite unhappy about him leaving. So was there more to that, Daryl, in terms of like how has that changed over the they were devastated when he left. How do they feel now?
Well, I think his point was that it has led to terrible morale.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that same article by Witz today, and it's not at all surprising that the morale is, however good the new director is, the morale when you lose someone like Comey is going to be very bad, and the manner in which he was lost makes it worse. I mean, that kind of a firing is just devastating.
Yeah, and I think the constant attacks by Trump on the FBI at, you know, in a couple of contexts just piles on that bad morale. So the low
right.
morale.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of talk that before the election, there were parts of the FBI that were, you know, very pro-Trump. And in fact, that this whole thing about the release 11 days before the election of the Clinton information was in part prompted by the New York division of the FBI basically threatening to leak it if Comey didn't. And things along those lines. So there's a part of the FBI, and of course, just looking historically, I mean, law enforcement in general and the FBI in specific historically have trended Republican. You know, they're always bipartisan. They're always Democrats and Republicans, but it's known as a more conservative institution, a more Republican institution. But the way that Donald Trump's administration has been talking about them, even the Republicans in the FBI have to be unhappy about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know my friend's political affiliations. We never discussed it when we knew each other in a previous life, but he might have been a conservative, but he's certainly not a Trump supporter.
Right.
Now.
So now the main things first of all, there wasn't really anything new in this book that we haven't heard before. I mean,
It's a little bit more flavor on it. It's Comey telling his story. But of all of the highlights we've heard, there wasn't any direct thing that's like, oh, my God, we've never heard that before. That's brand new news. And I think Comey has actually been very careful on that. There are certainly things that aren't public yet that he knows, but those are all things that he's not going to tell right now because they're related to investigations or whatever else that are still underway. And even when you've heard him in interviews, it's like he's paraphrasing things from his book. And you hear him say the same thing over and over and over in different interviews. So he's being really careful about what he says even now. But the main things that people have been talking about are once again digging up, did he handle the Clinton investigation properly and his two statements about Clinton during the campaign? And what's the relationship with Trump and anything more about Trump? Because he did basically spend a lot of time slamming Trump and all kinds of devastating quotes about how unfit for duty Trump is, etc. But did we all think he wouldn't? I mean, from everything we've seen, that seems like it was clearly where he was coming from.
Yep.
And on the Clinton stuff, I continue to think, as I have before, like, I think it's even clearer now than it was then, that Comey was not intentionally trying to elect Donald Trump. There were a lot of people saying that, you know, Comey intentionally threw the election to Donald Trump. He was doing this specifically to help Donald Trump. I think the evidence is quite strong at this point that that's not what he had in mind. I think he really was trying to sort of make the FBI look as good as it could in a nonpartisan way. And he just royally screwed it up. And, you know, I had thought at the time, you know, look, it would have been fair to release information about both the investigations into Trump and Clinton or neither of them, but revealing Clinton, but not Trump, was the worst of all possible worlds. I still think that's the worst possible world. I was arguing for a while, I think, that the best option would have been actually to reveal the fact of both investigations prior to the election. But I think I've come around to the right answer probably being neither of them, because standard FBI policy going back forever is you just don't reveal these things publicly while they're in play, and if there's an election involved, you wait till after the election, and those policies are there for decent reasons, and he would have been criticized no matter what. That's absolutely true. But I think the best result would have been to wait until after the election, wait until these investigations are complete, and then talk about them. And yes, that probably would have changed the result of the election. I think we've got plenty of evidence that among many hundreds of things that were enough to tip this election, given it was so close, his releasing that letter was one of those things. But as the Wits article points out as well, there's blame to go around. Obama's attorney general screwed up in a number of ways as well in terms of the handling of the Clinton investigation. But I don't know. I think I don't buy that his motives were bad, but I think he made a bad call. I think he made a very bad call. And I think the one thing he has not done in this book and this book tour is admit that how he handled anything to do with this was a mistake. But I think there's enough other talk in here of like, oh God, I hope it didn't make a difference, that he's actually kind of in a little bit of a denial about it, is really what's going on.
You know, I sort of interpret what he said as I listened to the interviews and the stuff, is that it's not so much that it was a wrong decision. Whatever he did was going to be a bad outcome.
Yeah.
And when you're faced with that, it's not so much that you decide, well, which will be the least bad outcome, and that's what I'm going to have to go with. And and then things, of course, turn out bad because it's a bad outcome. I don't think that I would characterize what he did as a mistake. I think he's a guy of integrity who looked at all the decisions and the possibilities and waited, and he made a decision. And weighing into that was Loretta Lynch's errors of meeting with former President Clinton, and all the factors. I think he probably did the I wouldn't say the right thing, but he did, the least bad of the things that he could have done.
I think he tried his best, and he honestly thought this was the best option he had. But the more I look at it, I'm like, there were written policies in place for how to handle this kind of thing, and he specifically decided not to follow those standard policies for how to deal with it. And I think in both of the cases of his initial statement that they weren't going to charge Clinton, but, wag, 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 you did a bad thing, you were stupid anyway, which I think is probably true. But the making of that statement was breaking standard policy for how the FBI deals with those kinds of cases. And certainly the statement right before the election. And I think all he had to do was follow the written policy, but
right. But I think he felt an additional factor, which was the fact that he had testified before I think Senate and said that if there was any change in the status of the Clinton investigation, that he would tell them. And I can see the point, but he doesn't have to fear the Senate as much as he has to fear the president in some ways. And so he probably should have deferred notifying the Senate until after the election, using the fact that there's this, tradition and written policy of not interfering in elections.
Well, and the other thing that's been pointed out is the time he issued that statement was before they knew what was in the content of the that computer. And
right.
They actually knew the answer to that question within a few days. He didn't even have to hold off till after the election. All he had to do was hold off until they could do that investigation, see what was in there, determine there wasn't anything of consequence. The Clinton thing taints everybody's view of Comey. And I think he said at one point that, he feels like everybody hates him. And I think, you're right. To some degree, everybody hates you because, the conservatives have the Trumpies have a variety of reasons to hate you regarding the Russia investigation. The Clinton folks have a variety of things to hate you about related to that. So he's right. But it's also one of these things where I really do think, again, he was trying his best. And you can criticize the specific decision, but I don't think, like, there was so much talk right after the Clinton stuff that he was intentionally trying to throw the election. And I don't know. That's not what was happening. He was trying his best in a difficult situation, and you may quibble about his decisions, and those decisions may have had a huge impact, but I don't think he was doing it out of a malicious purpose. I don't think he was doing it with the idea of, I'm going to screw Hillary Clinton. I don't think he was doing it with the idea of, I'm going to help Donald Trump. I think he was honestly trying to figure out the right thing to do, and he's actually fairly appalled that the end result of that may have been the election of Donald Trump, because he's also involved in all of this stuff trying to figure out what Donald Trump was doing. He also is directly in there saying, look, I interacted with Donald Trump. He's ethically challenged. He should not be president, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he has said, he made that quote that he does not believe impeachment is the way to go. He thinks the right thing to do is vote him out. But I don't know. I think, again, a lot of this conversation in the last week, though, has been just rehashing conversations that we've had going back a year and a half now in terms of how all this fits together, because the book is out. There's not a lot that's really new.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, I'm sure, as you mentioned earlier, he knows a lot more that he can't say just yet, so maybe there'll be a second edition.
Yeah.
Sometime down the road.
Okay, so let's take a break, and we'll be back with Cohen.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, we're back. So, Cohen, we did speak on the last show about the fact that there was a raid, but a whole lot of has been coming out since then. There are additional details about Cohen's past and his involvement in this and that, and all of that kind of stuff. And we had this sort of battle over how or who is going to go over the documents to determine which ones have attorney-client privilege and which don't. And that hasn't even been fully resolved yet as of the time we're recording. We found out that Sean Hannity was Cohen's third client besides Donald Trump. And I forget the name, some Republican bigwig financer who also paid a $1.6 million settlement through Cohen to hush up an affair. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, the least important thing is the Sean Hannity thing, probably, but it's certainly the most entertainment. It adds to the circus feel to the whole thing.
Yeah, although the interesting part about that, I agree with you so far, but especially since Sean Hannity is denying that he was ever a real client, blah, 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 it brings up, like, you know, Cohen could easily have said, you know, not listed him. So the fact that he has listed him as a client indicates that there are communications he has that have been taken as part of this raid with Sean Hannity that he doesn't want to come out. And that doesn't quite sync with, you know, Sean Hannity is like, oh, all I did was a couple of random things about real estate that don't really matter. There's got to be something deeper than that. Otherwise, why would Cohen bother listing his name?
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure Cohen's real bright.
Yeah.
In fact, that's sort of a compliment to him, because I'm pretty sure he's not bright. Even in the court, when the judge said, who is the third client, apparently most attorneys would write it down and hand it to the judge and let the judge decide whether or not to read it out. Instead, he fought with her for about an hour until she was so pissed off, she said, tell me the name. Yeah. And so then the name had to come out.
Actually, it turns out, like, even then, the debate was whether he had to give up the name at all. At that last moment, the lawyer said, do you want me to hand it to you in a piece of paper or do you want me to say it? She actually said, whatever you prefer. And he said it out loud.
And he should have written it. Yeah. So, as I said, I'm just not sure he's real bright, but...
That wasn't Cohen. Yeah. That was Cohen's lawyer.
Yeah. Well, he's probably no brighter, is he?
Yeah. Right. So, I think all of this Cohen stuff, we've also had reports for the last week or so that, you know, Donald Trump and his immediate team are now much more concerned about what's going on in the Southern District of New York related to this Cohen case than they are with Mueller. That they were completely blindsided by this. Apparently they did not expect it at all, that they were going to be going after Cohen. But now that they are...
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing that they had no clue that this was going to happen, because Cohen confessed. He admitted on, I think it was a TV interview or something, or maybe it was a newspaper. I don't remember what. He confessed to having paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 a week before the election or whatever it was.
Yep.
And that immediately raises, you know, suspicions about election finance fraud fraudulent wire transfer. I mean, it just, you know, any transaction over $10,000 is already viewed as a priori suspicious. When I read that some weeks ago, I was like, oh, well, this guy just got himself into a big pot of trouble, because you don't just pay off somebody that much money for their silence. And the of course, the thing that was brought up over and over again after that, that it looks like this is a campaign issue, a campaign finance issue.
Yeah, I mean, it may be a campaign finance issue, but that also gets the feds in the door to look at everything else, potentially. Yep. And apparently the argument they made to the judge in order to have this search warrant in the first place is like, look, he's not doing much lawyering. You know, he's doing a lot of stuff for Donald Trump, but most of it isn't actually legal advice. And so therefore attorney client privilege isn't attached. And even if he was giving direct legal advice, there are illegal activities there that he is helping to organize. And so therefore attorney client privilege isn't attached. The question is, if he's got all this long history of doing questionable things for Donald Trump and others, apparently, what are they finding when they dig in here? And Donald Trump can't get rid of this by firing Mueller, you know, either.
Nope. Well, the other thing is that Mueller's investigation has been incredibly tight about leaks. I mean, there just are no leaks, which is why we didn't hear about this until it occurred.
Right. But go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, the New York office does not have that reputation. There's going to be leaks all over the place over the next few weeks.
I think we already have. I actually said that on Twitter sometime in the last week, that the one thing we've seen out of this is that while Mueller has a tight ship, you know, SDNY leaks like a sieve, because we've already had a number of stories about Cohen and his behavior that almost certainly came out of SDNY in terms of what he's been doing.
The SDNY has a pretty good reputation of putting politicians in jail, too.
Yeah. The Attorney General of New York, which is, of course, separate, the state level, also has a reputation for doing those kinds of things. One interesting thing I saw was the current, this was just a few hours ago, the current Attorney General of New York actually put out a statement that apparently, Attorney General Snyderman, sent a letter to state lawmakers urging them to close a loophole in New York double jeopardy law, because apparently the New York double jeopardy law was written in such a way that it could be construed that a presidential pardon for a federal crime would prohibit the state authorities from going after that person for an equivalent state crime.
Really?
And so he states in his letter he does not believe that was the intent of the law, but they've put this loophole in, and he urges the New York State legislator to fix this quickly. And he specifically cites Donald Trump and the investigations that are going on because there's been speculation of Donald Trump trying to shut down investigations through pardons. So,
yeah. I recall hearing a discussion about the presidential pardon power, and I don't remember. Can the president pardon somebody before they've been charged?
Yes. The precedent for that, although he explicitly said this should not be construed as giving precedent, was Gerald Ford, Gerald Ford pardoned.
Oh, that's right.
Pardoned Richard Nixon before Richard Nixon had been charged for anything.
Yes, of course.
And so, yeah. Now, of course, that hasn't necessarily been tested in court. There are all kinds of things that haven't been tested in court that are potentially related to this case. What if Donald Trump pardons himself? Is that legal? What if Donald Trump pardons his kids? Is that legal? Et cetera. And the answer is, it probably is. The presidential pardon, as written in the Constitution, is very, very broad. However, doing so probably constitutes an abuse of power that would be impeachable. But in the meantime, he can do the pardon.
Yeah, so he needs to recursively pardon himself.
Well, he can't pardon himself from impeachment. But then that's a political question of, if he did that, is there the political will on the Republican side to do anything about it? And I think that's still an open question. If he starts out, and now a number of Republicans have said firing Mueller is a red line, you know, and I believe the same category would be like if he starts, pardoning everybody around him. I think, you know, there are some Republicans who would flip. Whether it's enough at that point, I don't know. But it would certainly really test the limits of our system's ability to deal with those things.
Yeah, well, maybe in Donald Trump's favor is there's probably a lot of Republicans he can win over by pardoning them as well.
maybe. I mean,
he's going to have to pardon a lot of them.
Well, and the other danger, though, of, just speaking of pardon power, for instance, is, If the president pardons you, you can no longer plead the fifth for testimony because you're no longer in danger for that particular charge. So potentially there's danger there. So like if Trump pardoned Cohen, let's say, for activities he had to do with this or Manafort or any of these guys, then potentially that makes it so they at that point have to spill their guts to investigators. Now, of course, they could still resist doing so, but then they're contempt of court or perjury charges or whatever. But those are potentially much lesser, they're lesser charges than what they would be guilty of otherwise. So that may be a trade-off that's worth it to them. The problem with all of these things is that so much of this relies on norms of behavior for the systems to work properly. It's not necessarily codified of you can't do this because it was assumed that nobody would do that.
Right. Like a president pardoning himself.
Right.
That would have been considered absurd 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Right. Or even the president, pardoning somebody who was still under investigation and hadn't been charged yet in order to stop an investigation. You know, now that hasn't happened yet. Maybe it won't happen. But the fact that it's being sort of openly hinted at is something nobody would have thought about a number of years back. So, OK, back to Cohen. Anything else to say? Particularly on him. I mean, we found out that he'd helped with that other Republican paying off the woman to be silent of the affair. So apparently this is just something he's done repeatedly. And he's apparently always worked with that same lawyer on the other side, which is a potential thing that's been brought up here, too, is if they were colluding. There's that word. But if he and the lawyer defending the people on the other side of those NDAs were actually working together this whole time and were not truly independent, that potentially invalidates all of those contracts and potentially is problematic in and of itself to him. Then there was this thing about a report, and so far only McClatchy has reported this. No other journalistic outfit has been able to confirm it, saying that Mueller has evidence that Cohen was lying about not being in Prague talking to Russian agents, I believe in July 2016, which was, again, one of the things in the Steele dossier. And this was the one thing that people had sort of pointed out oh, this part of the Steele dossier is actually clearly false. We found that it was a different Cohen, a different guy with the same name, who had traveled to Prague at that time. It wasn't him. So the Steele dossier was clearly wrong on this point. But McClatchy is reporting that the Mueller investigation has evidence that that's not true. And Michael Cohen actually did go to Prague in that time frame. Now, Cohen is still denying it. Up, down, left, right, center. And so I don't know. Did he or did he not? It's one of those things that I mean, when I first saw that posted by McClatchy, I was like, boom, because this changes all kinds of things. It gives even more validity to the Steele thing. It provides a direct connection between Donald Trump and the Russians in a secret meeting, blah, blah, blah. It potentially changes the dynamics of this case dramatically. But when no other news organizations have been able to confirm it over the next few days since then, you start to wonder, okay, can you really say that at this point? Maybe McClatchy is wrong. Because usually when you get a really big, you know, breaking news break like that, one news organization will come out first, but then over the course of the next, you know, couple of days, you'll have a whole bunch of other organizations work their contacts and be able to confirm that. And you have not.
I have a theory, but it's maybe based on obviously based on incomplete information. I think that Cohen, you know, was happy to show his passport to prove that he wasn't in Prague. And my theory is that he went to Prague, but never left international airspace, so he can rightly claim he wasn't in Prague.
So, well, there are a couple things there in terms of the passport would never tell you what you needed to anyway, because you could fly into anywhere in the Shenzhen zone in Europe, if I'm pronouncing that right, and then travel by land. So he could have, you know, flown to Germany and then taken the train to Prague. And nothing would show up in his passport, things like that. So there are all kinds of ways that he could potentially do that. But presumably there'd be a documentation trail there. And he has said repeatedly, I have never been to Prague in my entire life. He says that the particular dates in question, he was in L.A. with his son. So he has provided a bunch of specific information. Now, people have pointed out he's saying he's in L.A. these particular days, but the time frame that was alleged was actually a little bit vague, so it could be right before that or right after that or this or that. It's really unclear. He certainly has not provided enough evidence publicly to definitively say he was not ever in Prague. He's just sort of asserted it. I mean, like, again, even when he did that stupid thing where he tweeted a picture of his passport, he tweeted a picture of the outside of his passport. Like,
right.
Wouldn't even show anything anyway. It's completely
meaningless. But I mean, he said that his passport was his proof that he wasn't in Prague. But I think he can rightly claim it's misleading. But, you know, it's a very lawyerly thing to do. That if he's only been in the airport, in international airspace where he held a meeting, then he was not really in Prague. Just like I've never been in Taiwan, though I've flown through the airport.
Yeah, maybe. I don't remember the specifics of the document, whether it said anything about, like, where in Prague he met. Like, did it say he met in a diner or something? I don't know. So maybe he could make those arguments. I don't know. Does Mueller have evidence that he actually has been there or not? I don't know. Again, that's something that if that was true, it is a significant advancement in the case that there was something more than we've had evidence of so far about coordination between Russian authorities and the Trump campaign. But as long as it's just McClatchy, I don't feel like we should completely jump on that bandwagon. I would feel a lot more comfortable if other news organizations had been able to confirm something, and they've had almost a week and have not been able to. So anyway, let me check my notes if there's anything else specific Cohen related. I think we've about covered it. Is there anything else that you guys wanted to highlight or bring up?
Not on that.
Okay, then. With that, we'll take another break, and then we'll come back just to wrap things up and maybe hit a couple of other topics. We'll see. Back after this.
Alex and the West. Being Alex and Dad. Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day. YouTube by night. AlexMZilla.com. AlexMZilla is AlexMXELA. And .com is period and then COM.
Okay, I guess we're at the point of wrapping up the show then. Any last, even if it's completely unrelated to anything we've been talking about so far, any last things that either one of you want to bring up while you have the opportunity before we say goodbye?
Well, just a quick suggestion. Somewhere along the line, it might be interesting to address the fact that our government at the time, our government at a time where the economy is moving along pretty well, has a deficit that's probably going to hit $1 trillion in the very near future. And that's got a lot of implications for the future, but it's too late tonight to go into that.
Okay. Yeah, I think Yvonne and I talked a little bit about that last week as well. For anybody who missed last week's show, you can go back and see it. But yeah, it seems like in general, the... Yeah, and this fits in with everything. Like I said, Trump is all about initial appearances rather than thought through effects. And, you know, so something that does, you know, a short term boost in some way, even if it has negative long term effects, is perfectly in line with that.
But we're not even getting a boost.
Yeah.
the economy is doing no better than it was doing before this tax thing.
Although, to be fair, it's a little early to tell. The Republican standard, you know, of you want tax cuts and you want spending cuts. It's never been about the deficit per se. But it's not about smaller government either, because they're happy spending tons and tons on the defense sector. It's all about this, not wanting the specific types of spending they're against. It's not about financial discipline. It's not about this or that. It's, you know, we don't think government should be involved in these things, so we want to get rid of that and zero that out as much as possible. But these other things, that's absolutely fine. Let's spend a ton on that. And no, we don't have to pay for that with taxes. What are you, crazy? You know, we don't want taxes. We just want that stuff. So it's just a question of, yeah, this is one of the things where you look at the Republicans, you look at the Democrats, neither one of them are really worried about the deficit, except where it's convenient to be worried about the deficit. It's really just about spending priorities. Like, are you spending on X or are you spending on Y? And which one is the right thing to spend money on? And are taxes an okay way to fund things in general? So... I don't know. Anyway, Daryl, any last thoughts from you?
Yeah, I just want to say, completely non-political, thumbs up to Captain Tammy Jo Schultz.
Oh, yes.
For successfully landing a damaged aircraft and being so calm, cool, and collected about it.
Absolutely.
Excellent job.
I fly little planes, and once I was flying... flying around Stevens Pass in the mountains, and I got an oil leak that started coating the windshield, and I don't think I was as calm as she was, and mine was a relatively minor problem. That's the worst problem I've ever had. So listening to that audio recording, I was impressed.
Yeah, very much so. Okay, I think we have a show. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Daryl, for joining us yet again. And thanks to all our listeners for listening to another Curmudgeon's Corner. As usual, go to facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner to leave comments. Tell us what you think. You know, respond to the things we've said. Tell us we're wrong. Make suggestions for things we should talk about in the future. All of that kind of stuff. I'm at AbelSmay on Twitter. Daryl, do you want to give your Twitter?
Hominid_views.
There you go. And Ed, you don't have a Twitter, if I remember correctly. At least you're not on it.
I am unable to express myself in 250 characters or less.
But if you want to send something to us, we'll pass it along to Ed. You can also reach for feedback on the show in general, feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com. We'll get to both myself and regular co-host Yvonne. And of course, if you really like the show, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner, you can donate a little bit to the cause, help us with the basic costs of the show, all of that kind of stuff. At certain levels, you can get all kinds of little rewards, mugs and things like that. And at $2 a month, you can get access to the Curmudgeons Corner Slack, where a bunch of us just talk about the issues over the course of the week and share news articles with each other and potential topics for the next show and all that kind of stuff, and just have some random fun discussions. So that's a show. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Goodbye.
Okay. Good night.
Bye.